All right, I think we'll go ahead and begin. My name is Dr. Sean Hopkin. I'm an assistant professor in the religion department here at Brigham Young University and have been heavily involved, at least from my own perspective, in interfaith dialogue for many years, and am thrilled with you to welcome such a distinguished panel to this session on religious responses to secularisms. And I'm looking forward to hearing the three approaches from their own perspectives and their own contexts of how that's being done. Let me just briefly introduce our three lecturers this morning. This morning, and then we'll proceed. Each presentation will last 15 to 20 minutes, and we'll ask the presenters to do their best to stay within that timeline, which would give us then about, considering that we're starting late, 5 to 10 minutes. And so if we are on the 15-minute side of that, each paper, then we'll have more time, and on the 20-minute side of that, we'll have a little less time. But we will look forward to having at least a little bit of time to ask questions when done. We'll wait and hold questions until all three presentations have been given, so I'll encourage you to take notes and jot down questions as we're going. That will then give the opportunity for multiple responses from different participants as the need arises. So let me introduce in order in which they'll speak, and then we'll just move from one to the next. First, our first presenter will be Bishop Peter Comensoli, the apostolic administrator, correct? Of the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Sydney, Australia. After his presentation, we'll hear from Dr. Mohtasbi Abubakar, president of the Jamia Singapore, in Singapore. And then Dr. James Christie, professor of dialogue theology and the director of the RID Institute for Religion and Global Policy, and also of the University of Winnipeg in Canada. Again, thrilled to have all three of them, and without further introduction, we will turn the time over. And I will refer you to their biographies further in your program. We'll turn the time over to Bishop Comensoli.
Good morning, everyone. I'm rather grateful that I can stand up here and say to you I'm not a lawyer, and particularly happy about not being one today. So my presentation doesn't dwell on those sorts of things at all. We might go, yeah, stay on that one. So I'm going to have to use that, am I?
Here we go.
Okay, good. And I just want to make today 4 points to you. And those 4 points. The perspective I want to bring to our discussion today is not so much looking at secularisms, but looking at our responsibility as people of faith in being people who come to secular environments. So I'm obviously speaking from an Australian context, a very plural country, pluralist country, quite substantially secularist these days, though there are, the practice of religion is still something that is readily possible for all of us. So that's my perspective. So how, looking at some of the responsibilities that those of a religious affiliation have in a secular environment. And there goes my first slide. It's gone missing already. How does that start up? I didn't touch anything. honestly. I'm going to do this by telling four little stories to make 4 points. And my first story relates to the 2011 Australian census. So every 5 years, Australia has a national census of the country. In that census, there is a religion question where you can state freely whether you belong to a particular denomination or religion or no religion at all. In our 2011 census, and this is, you're wondering what that little symbol is up there. I didn't know what the symbol was, but I do now know what the symbol is. In our 2011 census, 64,390 Australian citizens indicated that they followed the Jedi religion. seriously. And this is supposed to be the symbol of the Jedi religion, so Star Wars and all of that. Typical Australians, most of them probably put it down simply because, you know, I don't want to answer a religion question, so I'll put down Jedi. But there are seriously some people who think that the fiction of Star Wars can be formed into some sort of religious philosophy, perhaps, and so on. And what's the significance of that? It's just this I want to point out as a responsibility that all adherents of a religious code or of conduct or set of beliefs have a responsibility to be able to reflect deeply on their convictions and to express them as reasons, so that we have a reasonable expression of the religious traditions that we all come from. In other words, those who are of a religious persuasion need to present the reasons for that persuasion in the context of the society or culture in which they find themselves. It's not a matter of willing my belief, but presenting it in a reasonable way. That's my first point. Simply reason, not will, is the responsibility of religious adherence within a society. My second one is this. Now, I've got to get this thing working. Yep, there we go. You might recognise the gentleman on the left is Pope Benedict XVI, now retired. The gentleman on the right is Chief Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, also now retired. But this photo was taken during Benedict's visit to Britain in 2010. I was in Britain at the time when that visit took place. For several months beforehand, an Australian, I have to admit, Geoffrey Robinson, a Queen's Counsel who now lives in Britain, was on the rampage, wanting to take the Pope to the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity, of all things. Because religion, and particularly Catholicism, and at that time still in some countries, including Australia, the whole issue of clergy sexual abuse was high on the agenda. So the Pope was seen as someone who was against the development of humanity. And he and some others were advocating very strongly for him not to be allowed into Britain in the first place, that he would be highly restricted in whatever he could do there, and that he was going to attempt to have him arrested in that time. Benedict lands in Britain in this environment of quite strong hostility in the media and in academia particularly. He lands in Britain, opens his mouth, and the picture changes immediately and comprehensively, because people start hearing him. Rather than the image, they start to actually hear the man himself and realize that he was proposing something to be considered by the people of Britain, not coming to impose something on them. And that's my second point. That us who are religious adherents need to be people who propose, not impose. And that certainly is a challenge that in some of the more hardline, if you like, secular societies in Australia now, where secularism is somewhat imposed upon people in all sorts of subtle and explicit ways. But that's not to be our way either. Rather, we are to propose something to our societies, not impose. So that's my second point. My third one relates to a particularly Australian event that happened. In 2005, in one of the Sydney suburbs, there were riots between people of essentially Middle Eastern Muslim backgrounds with groups of very secular Australian backgrounds. It was actually the western suburbs of Sydney versus a beachside suburb called Cronulla. And there were these riots that had resulted from the injuring of someone on a beach. That triggered these riots. These riots, though, were set up in a sense as two camps, two battlefields, if you like, or two armies, if you like, coming to do battles with each other with two entirely different cultural perspectives. Those in the Cronulla beach area didn't want anything to do with those Westies Muslim people. And the Muslim Westies were trying to come in and take over, supposedly, the beachside and culture and so on. What I want to make a point about this, though, is that is the issue of toleration or tolerance as a theme in our ways of thinking about being present within the secular culture. I'm not one who advocates for tolerance, because I think tolerance itself sets up two camps. One does not have to dialogue with another when toleration is the position that I take. Simply, I let them be. But there's not necessarily any engagement. So dialogue instead, I think, is the process that we need to do. So and this will be an interesting little point of discussion, I think, today, because I know already that the question of toleration has come up. But the challenge I want to throw out today is that I think that toleration is not the way to go, at least not as a paradigm for relations between religions and those of no religion, but rather dialogue is the only way that we can do this. And my last point. And this one comes from, again, an experience that we're having in the Catholic Church in Australia at the moment, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne and Brisbane, in the big capital cities of Australia. There has been a very substantial numbers of conversions to the Christian faith from Chinese immigrants, specifically Chinese immigrants. Particularly people who have come to study at our big universities, and they're coming to our churches seeking to become Christian. This is a pattern that's being also experienced by other Christian churches in other denominations in places like Sydney and Melbourne and so on. And why do I raise this as an issue? Well, what I want to point out here is that what often I'm hearing the stories from them who are coming to the Christian faith is that I've come from a culture where no religion is the reality, though we've heard, we know that's not the particular case in China. There's the plurality or the diversity that we heard of earlier on today. But for the ones that are coming forward, they come from this deeply materialist, secular, statewide reality. And they find that their innate religiosity starts to come out. And so they're wanting to touch that, and they're coming to the faith. And I simply mention all this as a final point, that there is hope for the future, that the secular paradigm is not necessarily what will be the case forever from now on. In the biggest country in the world, the most populous country in the world, at least those who can come to a point where they can experience the transcendent, they're putting their hands up in large numbers. And I think that's worth us remembering. Thank you.
Thank you to Bishop Commensale. We'll now turn the time to Dr. Buckar.
Very good morning to all of you. I would like to share with you on the multi-religious society living in secular Singapore. Secular countries practice different degrees of secularism. The model of secularism depends on how it defines the jurisdictional boundaries between the state and religion. A secular state is understood to be one where its governance does not and is not influenced by matters of religion and support neither religion or irreligion. A secular state is also one which treats all citizens equal regardless of religion and avoid preferential treatment of any of its citizens due to religion or non-religion. Between the two extremes of theocracies and atheistic system, countries have had to adapt and implement models ranging from cooperationist and accommodationist regimes. As a state with citizens of many religions, Singapore combines elements from both regimes and its continuing effort to promote peaceful coexistence of different religions and belief systems while striving to be neutral and even-handed in dealing with religious issues. The former senior minister of state of foreign affairs said, quote, "Singapore's unique model of secularism should be referred to as secularism with a soul. While religion must not mix with politics to incite subversion or undermine public order, clearly religion and public policy to engage as a matter of principle and accepted practice in this republic," end quote. A brief demography of religions in Singapore. Singapore is a very small island or country with an area of 270 square miles and a total population of 5.3 million as of June 2013. Religion in Singapore is characterized by a diversity of religious beliefs and practices due to its diverse ethnic mix of people originating from various countries. An analysis by the Pew Research Center on global religious diversity found Singapore to be the world's most religiously diverse nation. 83% of the citizens and permanent residents profess some religious faith: Buddhist, Christianity, Islam, Taoism, and Hinduism make up almost 83%, and the remainder is composed of atheists, agnostics, and other religions, including Sikh, Jewish, Zoroastrian, and Jain community. On the freedom of religion in Singapore, Article 15 of the Constitution of the Republic of Singapore guarantees freedom of religion in Singapore. Article 15, subsection 1, states, "Every person has the right to profess and practice his religion and to propagate it. Freedom of religion under Article 15, subsection 1, is not absolute, as it is qualified by Article 15, subsection 4 of the Constitution, which provides that the rights secured by Article 15 do not authorize any act contrary to any general law relating to public order, public health, and morality. These limitations upon the freedom of religion are an important aspect of Singapore's secularism. The Singapore courts have interpreted the term public order to be equivalent to the concepts of the public peace, welfare, and good order, referred to in Section 24, Subsection 1A of the Society Act. Rather than taking the narrower view that public order means freedom from unlawful physical violence. The word profess in Article 15, subsection 1, is not defined in the Constitution, but the case Muhammad Said Nabi, deceased 1964, may provide guidance. The issue in the case was the meaning of the word Muslim in the Muslim Ordinance 1957, which defined as a person who professed the religion of Islam. The High Court held that to come within the definition, one must be shown to be an Orthodox Muslim and must have outwardly manifested and practiced Islam. Merely having born into that religion was insufficient. In this case, the deceased was brought up as a Muslim, married under Muslim rites, and held Muslim religious ceremonies in his house, which he has taken part in. This was strong evidence that he professed the religion of Islam, despite the fact that he had also engaged in the heterodox practices of drinking alcohol and eating pork, which is prohibited by Islam. The judge held that such practices did not amount to renunciation of the religion and added that someone who has been born into the religion must be held to be a member of that religion unless it is proof he had adopted some other religion. On the restriction on the religious freedom in Singapore, the Constitution provides for freedom of religion. However, other laws and policies restricted this right in some circumstances. Publication and public discussions of religious issues are generally censored, along with negative and or inflammatory portrayals of religion. The government does not tolerate speech or actions that it deems could adversely affect racial and religious harmony. Under Article 15, Subsection 4 of the Constitution, a person's freedom of religion can be restricted by a general law relating to the public order, public health, and morality. The restriction of freedom of religion are an important reflection of Singapore's secularism. Singapore's secularism is similar to France's secularism in that both models seek to protect the state from religion. All religious groups are subject to the government's scrutiny and must be registered legally under the Society Act. The Singapore government restricts certain religious groups by application of the Society Act. In 1972, the government deregistered and banned the Singapore Congregation of the Jehovah's Witnesses on the grounds that its existence was prejudicial to public welfare and order because its members refused to perform military service, obligatory for all male citizens in Singapore, salute the flag, or swear oath of allegiance to the state. Although the Court of Appeals in 1996 upheld the rights of members of Jehovah's Witnesses to profess, practice, and propagate their religion, their religious belief, and the government does not arrest members of being believers, the result of the deregistration has been to make public meetings of Jehovah's Witnesses illegal. Nevertheless, since the 1996 ruling, no charges have been brought against persons attending or holding Jehovah's Witnesses meeting in private homes. In another instance, in 2002, four Muslim girls were suspended from school when their parents insisted that they wear the tudung or hijab, an Islamic headscarf, to national school. Section 61 of the Education Act empowers the Minister for Education to regulate schools, including prohibiting students from wearing anything not forming part of an official school uniform. While the parents eventually did not pursue legal proceedings against the ministry, the controversy showed the Singapore government's steadfastness in insisting on secularism and the challenges in reconciling secularism and freedom of religion in Singapore. Singapore government can also influence religious practice through the Maintenance of Religious Harmony Act. The Act was passed in 1990 and revised in 2001 in response to actions that the government view as threats to religious harmony. This include aggressive and insensitive proselytizing and mixing of religion and politics. The Act established the Presidential Council of Religious Harmony, which reports to the Minister of Home Affairs and is empowered to issue restraining orders against leaders and members of religious groups to prevent them from carrying out political activities, creating ill will between religious groups, or carrying out subversive activities. The Compulsory Education Act of 2000 mandates attendance at public school for all children, with few exceptions. In response to the concern for the Malay Muslim community regarding the fate of madrasas or Islamic schools, the government exempted madrasa students from compulsory school attendance at public schools. However, if a madrasa does not meet minimum standards or minimum academic standards, its students would have to transfer either to a madrasa that does meet such standards or to a public school. Other constitutional provisions in Singapore, in addition to Article 15, there are other provisions in the Constitution that protects religious freedom. Article 12, subsection 2, prohibits discrimination against Singapore citizens on the ground of, among others, religion in any law, in the appointment to any office or employment under public authority, and in the administration of any law relating to the acquisition, holding of, or disposition of property, or the establishing of, or carrying out, or carrying on of any trade, business, profession, vocation, and employment. Related to this Article 16, subsection 1, of which prohibits discriminations against citizens on the ground only of, among others, religion in the administration of public educational institution and in providing financial aid from public funds for the maintenance of education of students in any educational institution. The Constitution declares that religious groups have the right to establish and maintain institutions for education of children and to provide them religious instruction in those institutions. Nevertheless, no person may be compelled to receive instruction in or take part in any ceremony or act of worship of a religion apart from his or her own. In being secular, the government of Singapore practices accommodative and cooperative secularism. For example, the Central Provident Fund system facilitates the collection of mosque building fund contributions by Singaporean Muslims. This is a cooperationist move. And the number of religious holidays in Singapore are officially recognized. This is also an accommodationist one. A strict separationist model would not allow followers of particular religion to be exempted from general law. The Singapore Constitution, on the other hand, mandates special religious and personal laws and Sharia courts for Muslims. In conclusion, the Constitution of Right of Religious Freedom in Singapore operates within the structure of public order. Laws like the Maintenance of Religious Harmony Act aim to preserve social order. Singapore secularism provides a framework to promote for the peaceful cooperation or coexistence of different religion and belief systems toward which the government is neutral and even-handed. The Singapore government is not interested in the veracity of any religious belief. The government has demonstrated its neutrality by soliciting views from citizens, including the religious groups. For instance, on the casino issue, it made its final decision to go ahead with the integrated resorts despite the representatives of anti-casino lobby, which included the Islamic Religious Council, the Singapore Buddhist Federation, the Hindu Endowments Board, and the National Council of Churches in Singapore. Ultimately, the government based its decision on what is considered best serve the national interest. While disappointed, religious groups recognize the legitimacy of the government in a democracy to have the final say. They were heard, and that lends stability to the process. In Singapore, the government prohibits religious organizations and individuals from engaging in political activities. But I encourage to work with the government in the process of implementing policies. The different religious communities are consulted in policies which would directly impact on religious matters. Once the policies have been implemented, any prior opposers during the consultative sessions are expected not to be campaigned. This has led to the branding of the unique version of secularism of Singapore as a strategic secularism or pragmatic secularism by some observers. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Bakar, for those comments. Dr. Christie, we look forward to your presentation.
Good morning.
Hello.
I must say it's a privilege to be a part of this panel with such distinguished colleagues and in a room filled with such distinguished colleagues and friends. My late colleague and sometime mentor, Rabbi Jordan Pearlson, very often began his remarks by saying, "Before I speak, there are a few things I need to say." And there are three things that I need to say before I begin to speak. The first is that I am, given the nature of this gathering as so extraordinarily international, am in a position to bring you greetings, first from the Canadian Council of Churches, which is the largest, broadest, and deepest federation or council of churches, Christian churches in the world. The second thing to note is that the proper posture of the religious is a posture of gratitude and thanksgiving. And to that, I want to express my gratitude, certainly, to Brigham Young University and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints for pulling us together today and during the course of these few days. It is perhaps a salutary thing that it is one of the world's newest expressions of Christianity that draws so many of us from so many different religious traditions together here in Salt Lake City for this exercise in dialogue, which is, as our colleague Bishop Peter has said, clearly the way for the human community to move forward together in some degree of harmony and in peace. I'm also grateful to Sandra Palin, who is the public affairs officer for the LDS in Canada, for her contribution to the Canadian Interfaith Conversation, itself the first nearly successful iteration of a Canadian Council of Religions in our history. I hope so. Is it on? I would have not said so. Neil, anybody with a fine a hat is that. That is better, isn't it? The Canadian Interfaith Conversation, which is the first nearly successful iteration of a Canadian Council of Religions in our history. And the third is a disclaimer, and that is that I stand today primarily as a practitioner who enjoys the great benefit and privilege of having a university in order to reflect on that practice. So then, in any gathering of people who engage in serious conversation, there is almost always an unspoken issue, a huge unspoken issue, that creates a degree of discomfort within the context of that room. In Canadian religious circles for some years, that particular expression, the elephant in the room, has referred to secularism. Secularism is the context in which many of us work. In fact, it has so much become the context in Canada that we would go so far as to say that the elephant isn't simply in the room, the elephant is the room. And how Canadian religious communities attempt to exercise faith both with integrity on the one hand and with mutual understanding on the other is the challenge that we face. A word about the Canadian context. Just as in real estate, location, location, location is the key mantra, in the question of religious reality and secularism, then context is perhaps most important. I'd want to note that the Canadian experience would suggest that there are four constituencies in Canada. There is the constituency of the devoutly religious, not Christianity alone, but Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, Jainism, Sikhism, the Baha'i community, indigenous spirituality. Parenthetically, when we look at those constituencies, there are, for example, more Muslims in Canada than there are Presbyterians. And the fourth largest linguistic group in the Canadian mosaic currently is Punjabi, which is to suggest that Sikhism is an increasingly significant and growing religious presence in Canadian culture. Then we have the anti-religious, those persons who actively are convinced that a secular society and a healthy secular society is one that restrains, constrains, and ultimately eliminates religion from the public sphere. The third would be the spiritual but not religious, the SBNR, as Diana Butler Bass refers to this particular group within society. It is the largest growing, fastest growing segment of Canadian society currently, and generally is used to refer to those persons who might best be understood to be seekers, those who are disenchanted with traditional forms of religion, again, not only the Christian tradition, but Judaism and Islam, Hinduism, all of the others which I've hitherto mentioned. And certainly seekers form a particularly large proportion, it seems, of the SBNR. But it also ought to be noted that in the Canadian context, the spiritual but not religious also would have to include a significant number of persons in the Aboriginal community. In that sense, we have much in common with our colleague earlier from Nigeria, that there has been historically a suppression of indigenous spirituality. And a substantial number of the spiritual but not religious are the indigenous communities and the poor communities. Quite simply because in many of our religious institutions, there simply is no place for those who cannot afford the practice and participation in religious communities. Then there is, of course, the utterly indifferent. And the utterly indifferent, again, includes a significant proportion of Canadians and especially Canadian young people. Now, in a healthy secular society, which is what I believe we are struggling to build in Canada, there ought to be, and ultimately would be, place for each of those worldviews to exist in some form of harmony, to exist in such a way that they may engage in conversation and dialogue and mutual security. It is an unfortunate thing when in any society a person is obliged to conform to any belief structure, whether that belief structure is religious or secular, when it conflicts with their sense of conscience, their sense of vocation, and their very sense of identity. Fortunately, in Canada, though we are not always particularly adept at practicing effectively, we have a prevailing social value which ought to and mostly does provide for some degree of peaceful coexistence. And that prevailing social value is, frankly, the value that is best expressed in the two words, human rights. This is an increasingly prevalent social value, but not a particularly new one. Mention was made last night by Senator Hatch of the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Now, with all due respect to Mrs. Roosevelt, the Declaration of Human Rights, made extant in 1948 in the United Nations, was penned by Canadian diplomat John Humphreys. And exactly. And it was a most extraordinary document. You heard Senator Hatch refer to Article 16 concerning the freedom of religion, the freedom of practice of religion, not only individually, but collectively. And there is a sense in which I think that captured the hope even then in Canada of what the diverse nature of a country might actually contain and employ. Needs to be said, again, parenthetically, however, that there is one concern, and that is that it might be impossible today for the nations of the world to come together to adopt a document so radical in its essence as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It has been suggested, in fact, that the contention amongst many elements of the global community, including religious elements of the global community, would make it nearly impossible, perhaps as impossible as it must seem to achieve consensus among the 15 apostles, as we heard yesterday, around the world's communities. Ability and willingness to celebrate human rights as was suggested in 1948. Canada has continued on that tradition, that trajectory of human rights, when in 1982, at the initiative of then Prime Minister Pierre Elliott Trudeau, Canada repatriated its constitution. There was, at the time, a good deal of concern about what it would mean for a nation under the British tradition of law and governance to adopt a written constitution. Nevertheless, adopt a written constitution we did, with the exception of the province of Quebec, which continues, as so often it does, to have reservations about the rest of Canada. But we adopted not only a written constitution, but more importantly, a charter of rights and freedoms. And one of the most popular pastimes of the Supreme Court of Canada is, in fact, interpreting charter challenges, in which there is the attempt to assert on the part of various groups within Canadian society their rights and freedoms in light of the charter. Subsequent to 1982, virtually all provincial jurisdictions — Canada is a federal state with a national government, a federal government in Ottawa, and then 10 provincial and 2 other regional governments, 3 actually — and each of them have enacted, embodied, and attempt to live out some form of declaration or charter of human rights. The third element of this is a symbolic element, but not an insignificant symbolic element. And that is, on the 18th of September in this year, in Winnipeg, the city from which I currently hail, and which is at the very center not only of Canada, but at the very center geographically of the North American continent, the opening of the Canadian Museum for Human Rights was celebrated. This particular museum is a first of its kind in the world, a substantial investment financially, certainly, an extraordinary vehicle architecturally, but perhaps most importantly, the first national museum to be established outside of the national capital region, within reach of Ottawa. Its entire purpose is to try and document the story of the struggle of humanity to achieve a basis of human rights for every person and every constituency on the globe. And the very architecture of the building is a spiral climb towards a yet uncompleted tower that symbolizes the hopes and aspirations of people for human rights, including religious rights, around the world. In Canada, the reality is that religion is understood to be a principal human right. Aside from any intrinsic worth it may have, any expression of religion may have, it is understood to be a human right and is therefore to be protected. Being religious then becomes a matter of attempting to learn how to live within that framework of human rights. Human rights that respect not only the prerogatives, the privileges, and preferences of one religious community, but of all religious communities extant within the country, and those communities which, in fact, are not religious, and in some cases openly hostile to religion. Now, rather like Bishop Peter, I'm going to rely on story for the next few moments. It is my conviction that story is to religion as math is to science. And there are 4 stories or episodes that I would like to offer you to try and illustrate how we are struggling to live together with respect to a community that is based in the increasingly public value of human rights in the Canadian context. Well, the first is really a story which springs from a tragedy. In September of 1998, off the coast of Nova Scotia, off our Atlantic coast, a Swiss Air flight went down into the Atlantic, taking the lives of all those on board. As you can imagine, the outpouring of grief, the traveling of families and friends from Switzerland to Canada to take part in an opportunity to mourn, became a significant national event. A local team of clergy of various religious traditions, including Christian, Jewish, and Muslim, came together to engage in a process of planning, to pull together a service of worship to mark the mourning that was touching people worldwide as a consequence of this plane crash. However, The Prime Minister of the day, Monsieur Chrétien, was not a particularly religious man. Though his background was Roman Catholic, one of his favorite pastimes was fighting with Archbishop Gervais, the Archbishop of Ottawa. This may or may not have reflected in part on his having been expelled from three Roman Catholic schools, Your Grace, I'm not sure. But the personal, as feminists tell us, is the political, and Prime Minister Chrétien's office, referred to affectionately in Canada as the PMO, the Prime Minister's office, contacted the local Christian clergy and advised that person that there was to be no mention of Jesus Christ anywhere in the prayers. There was to be no explicit Christianity in the observance of the plane crash that took so many lives so tragically. Happily, it was the Muslim and Jewish leaders within the context of that community who rallied to the support of the Christian minister, and in the end, we had a degree of integrity of worship that was quite remarkable. More importantly, out of that came a significant and a very serious debate about the appropriate nature of supervision, shall we say, of the secular authority of the religious community. And the consequence was that the interreligious reference group of the Canadian Council of Churches developed during the course of the subsequent 18 months a document that was entitled Guidelines for Public Religious Observance When More Than One Religious Tradition Is Present. That particular document has now become normative within the context of Canadian society and is referred to both by religious communities and by secular authorities when those occasions require the opportunity for religious and secular authorities to engage together in common activities or moments. The second is an ongoing process in which there has been a continuous opportunity now from 2005 for globally as well as domestically the engagement of religious society and civil society. In 2000, the year 2000, Kofi Annan convened his Millennium Forum at the United Nations. Out of the Millennium Forum grew the collection of objectives for the world community referred to as the Millennium Development Goals, of which there were eight in principle. They involved a variety of ways, far from comprehensive and far from perfect, to call upon the global community to achieve some basic standards of improvement in the quality of the human condition by 2015. In 2005, Jim Wallace, the evangelical Christian who is also the founder of Sojourner magazine, and Rowan Williams, then Archbishop of Canterbury, began a process of religious leader summits that drew together religious leaders that we might call second tier, that is to say, not necessarily global leaders of religions of prominence, such as the Roman Catholic Pontiff, the Dalai Lama, the Archbishop of Canterbury himself, but rather leaders who were responsible for developing religious policy and polity within their particular communities. In 2005, while the G8 countries met to discuss their various agendas, including Millennium Development Goals, the first of these summits was convened largely virtually, but in some measure face-to-face in Lambeth, in London. Similarly, in 2006, there was an event convened in Moscow, again with the Millennium Development Goals as a factor. In 2007, in Cologne, it was made explicit that the MDGs would be the content of the discussions between world religious communities and the secular governments of the G8 group of nations. Not with the presumption that necessarily the political leaders of these purportedly democratic, or at least in some measure democratic nations who held the greatest degree of economic power on the planet would pay a great deal of attention to the ideas and aspirations articulated by religious communities, but rather that the religious communities would pledge not simply to be critics of the political system, but rather in some measure partners towards the development of higher aspirations for the human community. The MDGs themselves, hardly perfect, were seen as a Rosetta Stone of sorts, a common document which could provide for engaged dialogue between the religious and the secular authorities in the planet. For the full cycle of G8 meetings, from the UK in 2005 to the UK once again in 2013, the religious leaders came together to remind the secular leaders of these eight extraordinarily economic powers that they had made pledges and that they were expected to ensure that the MDGs as a sign of those pledges were maintained on their agenda in perpetuity. Of course, the future of the G8 now is in some degree in jeopardy, particularly given Mr. Putin's Ukrainian adventure earlier this year, which has disrupted the process. But in Germany in 2015, there will be a renewed attempt to address the MDGs during the course of the Kirchentag days. The third brief example or snapshot takes place in my own context, and that is with the Manitoba Multi-Faith Council. Beginning last year, in February, in fact, the Manitoba Multi-Faith Council felt that amongst its various constituents members, the question of how to address and to live with secularism needed to be somehow or other made tangible, incarnated, if you like. And so we convened for the first time, at least in the Canadian context, the Manitoba Multi-Faith Leadership Breakfast. It was not intended to be a breakfast for religious leaders, although religious leaders were certainly present. It was intended to be instead a gathering point for leaders in the community, and the theme was and will continue to be in future years, for the sake of the city. The first speaker was Police Chief Devon Clunas, himself a Trinidadian by birth, an evangelical Christian, who created a degree of controversy when first appointed by calling upon all the citizens of Winnipeg to pray for the city. He reiterated that call in February of 2014, but this time, instead of round criticism, he received the support from community leaders in business, in politics, in communications, in athletics, in virtually every aspect of the city's life. And then lastly, something that I think is unique in our jurisdiction, in fact, I'm sure it's unique in our jurisdiction in the world. Canada remains, to the chagrin of some of us, a constitutional monarchy. A couple of nodding heads, those are those who got the in-joke. We remain, to the chagrin of some of our citizens, a constitutional monarchy. That means that our head of state is technically Elizabeth II, and in practical respects, the Governor General of Canada and the Lieutenant Governor of each Canadian province. Since 2007, we have been able to institute as what can only be described as a kind of spontaneous citizens movement or coalition, something called the Lieutenant Governor's Award for the Advancement of Interreligious Understanding. That particularly long title belongs to the Protocol Office of the Lieutenant Governor, not to any of us in the religious communities. It's worthy of note because it actually sprang from the 2007 publication of the Holocaust Journals of Pope John XXIII. A most extraordinary story in which Angelo Roncalli, a papal nuncio in Turkey during the war, actually worked with the Irgun and Haganah underground in Europe to ensure that Jewish refugees could be bought out from under the Nazi regime in Bulgaria and Romania and literally smuggled through Turkey into what was then the British Mandate of Palestine. An extraordinary interfaith exercise involving Roman Catholic Christians, Turkish Muslims, and, of course, Palestinian Jews. To mark that, it was suggested that there might be an award established that would acknowledge that kind of interreligious collaboration. And in fact, that's precisely what happened. The lieutenant governor, who is a civil official, called upon to represent all of the citizens of the province of Manitoba, confers an award for the advancement of religious understanding, a point of intersection, which we believe is extraordinarily unique. Well then, in short, and to conclude, we have a secular society in Canada. Any other kind simply is currently unimaginable. That ship has sailed. But that particular secular society that we're struggling to build is intended to honor, on the basis of human rights, all of our constituencies and all of our citizens. In some ways, it reflects a remark that was made by Dr. Hans Kung in 1984 at Riva del Garda. Dr. Kung observed that there will be no peace until there is peace among religions, and there will be no peace among religions until there is dialogue amongst religions. We're pushing that quote a little bit further to argue that there will be no peace until there is dialogue amongst religions in the context of a secular society that, within a framework of human rights, honors the dignity and the prerogatives of all. Thanks.
All right. Well, thank you for those three excellent presentations that I think dovetail very nicely with each other. There is some time now to ask questions of the presenters. We've got someone here with a microphone. If you'll stand and first mention where you're from, what institution you represent, and then direct your question to one or multiple presenters. Let them know who you're directing the question to. Thank you.
Thanks to all three presenters. I actually have questions for all three, but I have a limited time. So I'm just going to focus my question to Bishop Comensoli. It's really hard not to agree that dialogue is the best way to engage each other in a robust way. But does that mean we should dismiss the value of tolerance? Because it seems to me that it continues to have significance for how we relate to each other, not just in societies that are undergoing conflict, so we need the minimalistic way of sort of treating each other some way without violence, but also in any society. Because the question is, can we ever fully understand each other, or can we ever fully understand the other? And even a friend, to some extent, always remains a stranger.
I was being slightly provocative in my remark to start with. However, I did preface by saying this is coming from an Australian perspective. I imagine, and from what I've seen anecdotally, being tolerant of others within some societies is the very basis on which things need to progress. From this Australian perspective, though, my difficulty with when toleration becomes the paradigm is the problem. When the only point we get to is toleration of one another, then there is no coming together possible, because toleration in that sense ends up simply being I will allow you to do whatever you want to do so long as you do not interfere with allowing me to do what I want to do. And so people remain in their particular positions without ever coming to a point of engaging deeply with one another. In a sense, toleration is a competition as a paradigm. So seeing how there might be a competition between various groupings, and they get to a point where there's some sort of semblance of harmony, perhaps. But there's no genuine engaging with one another. There's no movement towards friendship, in other words. So that's the point I'm trying to emphasise. Provocatively, I know, but nonetheless, if we think we can remain simply at toleration, as a paradigm, then there will be no point where we can come towards friendship.
Neville Rocco from Australia. I'm an adjunct professor at Notre Dame in Sydney and also at Adelaide University. Thank you, first of all, for outstanding remarks. It was very provocative, Bishop, but it was also thought-provoking in the most genuine of senses. My question is really to the panel, and what I'm searching for as a lawyer always is some guiding principle. And I just wonder if any of you have any comment on how one distinguishes clearly by reference to principle the difference between a claim and a genuine right. It seems everything these days is claimed to be a human right, but only a small subset of those things that are the subject of those claims can genuinely be called so. Human rights is, I think, in danger of losing its reputation of something noble and falling into a pit of ignobility unless there is a guiding principle to distinguish the two.
Was it Henry V, Neville, in which it was observed the first thing we do is we kill all the lawyers? Henry IV, that's a provocative question and a helpful one. I think the two observations I'd make out of the Canadian context is the first that, quite frankly, it is a work in progress. There are claims that are made before both regional and the Supreme Court around human rights that would seem to be not necessarily frivolous, but perhaps certainly ill-grounded, where human rights are used perhaps as a justification for particular attitudes, behaviors that that might not be considered something of the rights nature throughout the country. And within the context of court cases, the charter challenges keep emerging. And what we find that is helpful in terms of dialogue is that in this work in progress, what we begin to find is that we have an ongoing and robust conversation about precisely your question, what is a human right as opposed to a claim to a human right? And we're continuing to refine and to define that, sometimes painfully. To give you a very quick example, in the autumn of 2013, the Patsy-Québécois government in the province of Quebec determined that people's right to a security and comfort in being served by the public service in the province would be best achieved by the banning of all visible religious symbols. That was understood to be the right of persons to feel unthreatened and under no prejudice on the part of a civil servant. On the other hand, the religious communities felt that their rights were being impinged upon by virtue of the secular charter. That's still an ongoing conversation. However, it does need to be said, perhaps in the terms of Vox Populi, Vox Dei, that on the 7th of April, the Patsy-Québécois government and their charter of values was so roundly defeated that, in fact, they've never suffered so limited an electoral standing since their founding in the early 1970s. The second aspect for us is that we have the two charters upon which we base a life as a kind of a template almost. The one is the 1948 Charter, but more importantly, and in judicial terms in Canada, it's the 1982 Charter of Rights and Freedoms. But it is an ongoing process that in and of itself is a dialogue within Canadian society.
Because we began late, I think we'll take one more question and we'll impose on graciousness we've got on your graciousness and take just a couple more minutes. Let's take our last question here if we could.
Yeah, thank you. Andrea Pin from Italy, for the Bishop. There's a common ground amongst the speakers about the role of dialogue amongst the religions. Interestingly, Bishop Comensoli ended up with the idea of hope, which you link back to the fact that you have Chinese converting to Christianity, for instance. So the end of a speech was about religious experience, not just about religious dialogue. And in one sense, I can see that. But I would like to know more about the relationship between dialogue and religious experience as being the very hope for religious freedom. Does it make sense? You identified the hope with people converting, you know, taking the faith seriously, not just dialoguing. And I'd like just to have more.
Okay. I think the point that on that particular example was to highlight the sense in which when someone is free to be able to experience something of the transcendent, allow that to come forward within their lives, then they want to take it up. Which poses for me a question around the general human experience of the transcendence, and that we give expression to in the various religious traditions from which we all come. Now, to have the experience is one thing. To have also the reasons for that experience and to give it a general shape and a reasonableness as a human person is also important. So both the experience of and the reasoning about need to go hand in hand. And that's why I started with the point that it's not our willing of a religious experience that is in the end in terms of the context of our discussions what's important, but being able to provide good reasons. So in the end, I stand before you saying I'm a Catholic Christian, that I have reasons for my belief and that I think those reasons are worth sharing with someone else. And so it comes from my experience. I take it to be a genuine human experience, so nothing to do with the cultural society or the background from which I come, but that this is something innate of human beings, an openness to the divine. But then how do you translate that and communicate that? And that leads us into the questions of dialogue.
All right. Thank you, everyone. And a huge thank you again to Bishop Commensale, Dr. Bakar, and Dr. Christie for those intriguing presentations.